There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
On this podcast, we talk about some bullshit for way too long.
Hello and welcome to a very special episode of Dungeon Deep Dive. We are back in the studio, and by we, I mean, to my right,
I'm Lachlan, or so I've been told.
And directly ahead of me,
I'm Grace, or so you've been told.
And so I'm telling you, I'm Tully Grimley. And hopefully this isn't the first episode you're listening to, but if it is...
Not a strong start if it is, so I'm sorry, off the bat.
Not our wittiest intro.
I think we're very funny.
Oh, okay. I stand corrected.
You know what?
Yeah, we have the jokes and the japes.
This conversation here, this could be a podcast.
Oh my God. We should make a podcast.
We should make a podcast.
We should start a podcast.
Oh.
No?
Oh. I'm into it.
Yeah? Excellent. Well, we'll be starting a podcast soon. Before we get started today, we would like to acknowledge that the land on which we stand is the traditional home of the Turrbal and Yagara people of what is now known as Brisbane or Meanjin. These lands have always been places of teaching and learning and storytelling. And we'd like to pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging.
Fantastic. And with that, this week, gang, we are talking about everyone's favourite stinky green fellas.
Well, before we do that, in case we do have any brand new listeners, do we want to talk about what the podcast actually is?
Ugh, no. When do we ever do that? Fine. Okay. On this podcast, we talk about some bullshit for way too long.
That's probably a much more accurate read of this podcast, to be honest.
It's a world-building podcast. We go into detail, looking into the history and the mechanics of things in the past that might be a little bit difficult to implement in, I suppose, a like natural and fulfilling way in your stories and D&D games and stuff. We mostly talk about D&D, but it's system agnostic.
Yeah. And one of the big things about what we do is we're trying to find ways to make these little things interesting. Not every game has to be completely, perfectly accurate for everything that it does, but each week we look at a different topic and we find a way to bring that into your world in a way that is a little more interesting, that brings some life to the world.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a difference between just very rigid historical accuracy, I think, and understanding that the things that we have in our games developed in history for a reason. And whether or not you want to actually use the actual historical reasons that these things came about, like whether you give a shit about what the old stories of ogres say that ogres came from and what they were like, for example, you don't have to use any of that. But I just think it's important to remember that these things did come about from something. None of this is like just appeared in a vacuum. And I think that if you're going to be changing things, it's worthwhile to understand the detail so you can make sure that the thing you're changing it to still has that detail.
Yeah. And that's a nice introduction to what we're doing.
It's probably too long of a one, but that's fine.
That's all right. As Lachlan said before, today we're looking at our big green stinky fellas, our ogres, and talking about the fact that for most of the time, they were big and stinky, but they weren't green. Not always.
Sometimes.
Sometimes. There were green ones. There were green ones.
Depends on where you go, really.
Mm.
Should I kick us off?
Yeah, if you want to kick us off. Okay. So what are you looking at today?
So I just kind of wanted to get into where does this idea even come from? Because Tully and Grace are going to talk about what we did with the idea, like what ogres became and what you can make them into in the game and everything. But I was wondering, it's one of those things that's very established in our like culture. It's just like we know what ogres are. You ask anyone what an ogre is, and like there's almost, whether they give you the same answer or not, there's almost nobody that speaks English that's not going to be able to give you an answer to that question. Which is odd, because it's a lot of, I feel like a lot of our monsters and stuff that we have very clear links back in history with something else. Like you look at like stories of vampires and stuff, and that maps pretty well one-to-one to like old demonology from various cultures.
Yeah.
You look at stories of like ghosts and stuff, very, very obviously come from like religion and spirituality and everything. But ogres are weird because they're just kind of
there.
Nasty, stinky guys.
I refer to them as nasty, sexy guys.
That's true. They are pretty hot.
There's a reason why they're so prevalent in our mythology.
They're sexy.
I watched Shrek. That's all I have to say. You didn't find,
and that's the episode. Find, thank you for listening this week.
You didn't find Shrek sexy. We all watched the second movie.
Ooh,
that's true. That movie was,
yes.
I really liked it at the end when he became hot again.
Yeah.
Yes.
The problem with it though is, and I think the reason that it's harder to work out where the direct line back through history for ogre myths are, is because, to quote Robert Fowler, who wrote this book on early Greek mythography, there is a notable lack of canonicity in the myths. There is almost no agreed upon progression here. We have some pretty good ideas. So the best idea that we have is that ogre is probably a French word, and we believe that it came from the name of the Etruscan god, Orcus. Mm. Orcus was there's a word for it, the god of the underground, essentially. It's interesting. So apparently the way that these gods developed was they weren't, at least Orcus wasn't originally like a Hades figure, wasn't like an underworld figure so much, as was literally, he was literally the god of like the underground.
Okay, so this is, it's still like the place we put the dead, it's still the things under the earth, but it's not, there is another underworld. That is, it's more that this is the god that rules everything under where we stand.
King of the Worms, baby.
King of the Worms.
They are called.
Okay, so I'm introducing a new good guy for you guys to get to know in your campaign. It's King of the Worms.
King of the Worms.
Yeah, here we go. They're chthonic deities in, under, or beneath the earth. It literally means subterranean. So that's Hades. That's Dispata was the Roman one. I couldn't think of the Roman one. And yeah, sorry, I'm all over the place. This is ridiculous.
That's right. Most of it's, I'll just cut out some silences, we'll be good.
Also, for context, we're recording at 11 a.m.
Yeah, this is so unusual. Usually we finish recording somewhere close to 11:30 p.m. So this is, the sun is out, there's people around, it's wild.
It's disgusting. The vibes are far different.
Yeah, there's a very... Let us know what the difference is between a morning recording and an evening recording. And
they can't remember our evening recordings. We were recording from Lachlan's bedroom for so long.
Yeah, true. Either that or on Zoom.
God.
Oh yeah. We should preface this by for any international listeners by saying that in Queensland right now we have basically passed the whole thing, which is incredible.
Yeah,
but to all our listeners overseas, especially in the US, please, please stay indoors, respect social distancing, wear a mask when you do have to go outside. It is the only way that we have managed to keep our place from becoming an enormous mess full of death and disease.
Especially if you're out protesting, which is incredibly important right now. The Black Lives Matter movement is doing some phenomenal work around the world. But it is really, really important if you're getting out there to remember to be using your PPE, to be washing your hands, to be doing all those things, to be social distancing as much as you can. Because, I mean, go out there and do the right thing and fight for what's right and everything, but
don't like
try to make sure that you're not putting everyone else in danger doing.
Yeah, don't get yourself infected. Don't get anyone else infected. Always act as if you have the disease.
Mm.
Fun fact. One new case in the last 24 hours here. Mm. I'm really impressed by that.
And that's since borders opened from Victoria as well.
Our borders open on the 10th.
I mean, there are planes coming in anyway.
That's true.
Yeah. They're not officially open, but they're open. Anyway, enough of that.
Yes.
Lachlan, as you were saying?
Okay. So, yeah. Orcus, and interestingly enough, Orcus actually does appear in D&D as a demon.
God of Undeath?
The Prince of the Undead.
Prince of the Undead.
Yeah. So, the Etruscan civilization, just to preface, was around just before the beginning of the original Roman Kingdom.
Okay.
And it was the rise of the Roman Kingdom that led eventually to the decline of the Etruscan, was it a empire? The Etruscan, I don't actually know what they were. Whatever their civilization was.
Mm.
I don't remember off the top of my head. The Etruscans. Read it earlier. Yeah. So
the Etruscan squad, it is now official.
Orcus was kind of adopted in a sense by the Romans.
Mm.
Because there was this way that the Romans would try to discuss things from other cultures. It was a specific policy where essentially they would try their best to map the mythology of other cultures onto Roman mythology. The idea kind of being that, like, well, if our religion is right and these people believe in the god Orcus of the underground, then that probably actually is Disparta, our god of the underground, and they just have a different name for it. Or, at the very least, was trying to create, like, an equivalent between the mythologies.
And that does explain the incredible similarities between Roman and Greek mythologies as well.
Mm-hmm. There was a big movement in Rome, even during the rise of Catholicism, to explain the theology and the philosophies and everything that were like really prevalent at any given time through Greek mythology.
I really want to see the early justifications of Catholicism through traditional Roman mythology.
Yeah, who does Jesus kin?
It was... A lot of it was using, like, nature metaphors and stuff. So rather than trying to take the idea of, like, the ideas of Catholicism and mapping them onto paganism, as paganism was on its way out, they would use, like, the rhetorical devices and the symbols and stuff of paganism. And they would use a lot of, like, so there was a lot of, like, anatomical allegories, which was very common in... like pagan culture, there were a lot of a lot of references to like an untamed nature that kind of contained the divine within it. Just this idea of, and I believe there was a contrast drawn between the ideas of like pagan gods that existed within the world and the Christian god that existed without it. Like they just like, so a lot of the mythology started to fall away around the time of Catholicism, but the imagery that they used was just changed to suit Catholicism.
Yeah.
Whether that is a rhetorical move or was just a fact of, like, that was the culture that Christian apologetics authors grew up in, so that was, of course, the language that they used to talk about their beliefs, is up for debate, and there is debate about that, but they definitely did, at the very least, adopt the imagery. Even into justifying monotheism. But Orcus, though...
Orcus.
So there are some depictions in what was originally believed to be the tomb of Orcus at Tarraconia, which was a place in Etrusca. But it looks like the actual images of Orcus, the images of Orcus looking very like ogre-y that we have now, might have just been because there was also that tomb was actually the tomb of a Cyclops. And Orcus was just like the god that kind of dealt with that stuff.
Okay.
So I think it was a temple to Orcus, but the figure was a Cyclops, which is really interesting. So you can then kind of see from this the influence of like Greek ideas about Cyclops really influences the development of the yoga myth from that point onwards. Because for instance, as I'm sure you guys will get into, ogres are often like surprisingly good craftsmen. They're often like these kind of timeless, strong figures who are like who really excel in like whatever certain areas that they're supposed to excel in. Like for instance, there are the old Greek cyclopses that were master craftsmen. The cyclops in the Odyssey is a shepherd. They're always like they always have a job that is beyond them just being a big monster, being like an adversary.
Yeah.
And that comes from this idea of this ancient Greek and this kind of pagan idea of the like inhabitants of the old like golden age of mythology. Because what they believed was that this era was kind of before the gods. It was before like a lot of the things that we know of as happening within Greek mythology were thought to have even occurred. And so the world was largely inhabited by monsters and by like wild animals. And so that kind of monsters were, and in fact I'll grab the quote because it is a good quote. Here we go. Yeah, so this is talking about how the cyclopses are kind of like these timeless things that come from this like mythical golden age. And it says, Fowler says, "The golden age itself is an ambivalent concept, signifying both primitive barbarism and innocent perfection. Its inhabitants are very different from ordinary humanity, and one must tread carefully in their presence. The same insecurity attends anyone dealing with wild animals, those other denizens of the golden age." So it's this idea of, like, monsters weren't just unthinking brutes or just these cruel, cannibalistic threats.
They weren't pure evil.
No. There was nothing irredeemable about a monster. A monster was more akin to the Fae in the idea that they are just these ancient, unfathomable creatures that come from a brutal and ancient culture in a time that you couldn't understand, dealing with creatures that you could never even fathom, and so their sensibilities and their, like, ways of socializing and their just ideas about right and wrong are so unfathomable to us. Unfathomable in the same way that we don't understand the moral values of the animals that we encounter.
As a bit of a side note, I just find it very interesting to track the mythology being these creatures are unfathomable back in a time where it was okay not to know things, as opposed to now where we are all expecting everyone to be experts at everything all the time, not being comfortable with anything that we don't understand, having it instead be, oh, it's bad. It wants to kill us.
And that was, I think, a big fact of pagan life in general, was just this understanding that sometimes there were things you just weren't supposed to know, or that you weren't supposed to know all about. It just wasn't your time. The gods didn't tell you that, and so it wasn't your information to have. And so you weren't supposed to know how to interact with the Cyclops, because Cyclopses weren't us. They're these ancient, scary, and powerful things. And they're not scary because they're violent necessarily. They're scary because they're incredibly powerful, and we don't understand them enough to know how they want to use their power. We don't know what a Cyclops is going to do, because when the Cyclops says to starts talking to Odysseus in the Odyssey, for instance, it just starts by asking him his name.
Yeah.
And then he doesn't realize, he obviously does realize because he doesn't give it his name, but the idea is that you could talk to that Cyclops and not realize that that Cyclops was essentially marking you for death by asking your name, because the next thing that comes out of the Cyclops' mouth is Odysseus says, "I am nothing," and he says, "Well, I'll eat nothing when I wake up." And then he goes to sleep. And that's when Odysseus stabs Polyphemus, the Cyclops, in the eye, because he's going to be eaten by him just because he answered his question. Just because he was there and answered his question. Like, they're these horrifying, just, like, ambivalent creatures. And obviously they have influence coming from a lot of other things. There's some clear influence coming from biblical accounts of giants, sometimes called Nephilim. There's a... I don't remember what the Hebrew name is for it, but there's another name for them in Hebrew.
Does that also track on German mythology?
Because
Because there's the German myths of Nibelung, I think it is, or Nibelheim. And it's these giant master craftsmen. And so they were expert forgers and expert jewelers and just stunning blacksmiths.
Oh, yes, the dwarves, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and no, so it comes from exactly the same thing. And in fact, this book that I have about early Greek mythography directly draws the links from, like, those ideas of, like, of these old, ancient, timeless craftsmen. Like, and they were timeless, it seems, largely to fill some gaps in the mythology. Like, they were considered to be immortal because they were actually rewritten. One of the stories was rewritten to make them immortal and then surviving an encounter with Apollo that the original myth said that a bunch of cyclopses were killed by, purely because it seems it gave a good reason for some armorsmiths to be forging weapons for Zeus in a battle that like came later in the myth, and there wouldn't have been anyone around to make those thunderbolts for Zeus, so the myth was slightly altered because they were like, well, this doesn't make sense, so maybe it happened a little bit more this way. And that, I think, is where a lot of the discrepancy comes from. A lot of the discrepancy seems to come from the fact that these myths were intended to be debated. You weren't supposed to know exactly what had happened in any of these stories. And in fact, English originally developed, at least English prose styles, originally developed to specifically accommodate that. Because... it was a little bit of a tangent because I was reading it for a different episode, but I thought that it really spoke to a lot of the discrepancies here. The way Old English was structured, and I'm sure you guys have read it, the times where you'll see a passage from Old English and instead of being broken down into like distinct sentences, it'll say, what's a good example?
And lo, the shepherds looked upon the burning castle and they saw the fearsome wrath of the creature and the city was razed to the ground and would never bear fertile fruit again. And they fled from the land. It's the eternal run-on sentence.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's true. In Old English writing, they really didn't put in much punctuation kind of at all. It was just this like big wall of text. Here's a good example. So this is a story about, this is just from a chronicle. And it's talking about, in this year, this person and the Council of West Saxons took the kingdom off of this person because of their unrighteous deeds. And they had, except for this district. And he had that district until they did this. And he dwelt there until the swineherd did this. And he avenged the alderman and this. And then this guy came and did this. And this and this and this and this. And then during the 31 years, he did this and this and this. And it's always and.
So you've got a 17-page sentence.
Exactly, exactly. And you'll see if you look at like chunks of prose and stuff, or if you read like stories from the era, specifically the story that I was looking at was an Arthurian tale, Sir Gareth, because all of that shit, Mallory, the guy who wrote it, wrote all of his stuff like that. And it seems really tricky to read, and it seems like it's like kind of counterproductive. And even scholars have said like this is indicative of like an unsophisticated style. He has, like, the ideas of a good novelist, but he doesn't have the sophistication to put it together in, like, a complicated and interesting way. Because French, which was developing, like, literature as we know it at the time, because French was the language where the idea of, like, conjunctions and stuff came from. Instead of joining sentences together by an and, French would be like, well, this guy went down to the shops and he did this. For when he did this, he would go and blah, blah, blah. Well, and
I actually happen to have a 16th century French... a 16th century French story up right here in my notes.
Oh, cool, yeah.
He got up early in the morning and went out to the riverside, where he filled his pockets with small white pebbles and then returned home. End of sentence.
Mm-hmm.
There's stuff like...
Yeah, which is...
I am resolved to lose them in the woods tomorrow, which may be very easily done, for while they are busy in tying up bundles of wood, we can leave them without their noticing. It's like a lot more cause and effect.
Mm-hmm. Whereas in Old English, that would be written more along the lines of, and we can go and get wood, and getting the wood, we can leave it without them noticing, and without them noticing, we can blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, so it's probably going to sound, in Old English, it'd be more like, and he planned to lose them in the woods tomorrow, and he could do this very easily. And when they went to the woods, they were busy tying up bundles of wood, and they were able to leave them, and they went unnoticed.
Yeah, there was a lot of repetition, a lot of alliteration, and all of the things were separated by these ands. And it seems to be that one of the main reasons for this was it let the author draw more stark comparisons between two things. You could, rather than explaining the link between two things, just say, for instance, in a passage that that's talking about the relationship between Lancelot and Lady Gwendolyn, there is a knight essentially trying to argue, no, don't Arthur, don't be mad at Lancelot because he's in love with your wife, because your life's in because your wife is also in love with him. And the way that Malory talks about it to ensure that you can get his subtle opinion that he agrees that this love is true is he'll, instead of being like, well, I think it's true because of this, this, and this, it'll be like, well, he draws attention to like specific vocabulary thing.
I wonder if this is why all the French fairy tales are just like way better.
Well, that's
like
the thing
every version of a fairy tale we've got, you track it back, and it's like four dudes in Paris one year decided to just like write it all down.
It's yeah, it's the French or it's the Brothers Grimm. That's it.
That's true.
And even the Brothers Grimm, they took it all from the French and just made it darker. Well, they did the gritty Batman remake of the French tales.
They took it from the Germans and wrote it like French.
Yes.
Yeah, no, Germany, were they like...
Germany was surprisingly good at myths.
Yeah, they were like, we have horrifyingly huge forests and really horrific weather, so we're all going to sit inside and be like, ooh, what's the monster in the woods? If you don't stay inside, children, the monster will come and eat you.
Yeah, I'm sure yours is pretty much the same, but all of my early works that I work on, that I talk about are French, and then there's like one Italian book.
Mm.
And that's it.
Mm.
But yeah, so the way that Old English could work to draw these interesting comparisons was, for instance, in this passage where Malory, the author of some of these Arthurian legends, is talking about how essentially Lancelot wants to fuck King Arthur's wife.
Mm.
To make it clear that he thinks that this is like a pure and legitimate relationship between the queen and the knight, he'll talk about like, well... Yes, Lancelot was found in the Queen's chamber, and you think that it's for an evil reason. But I know that the Queen is really chill, and she's really good. And I know that she sent for Lancelot to reward him because he was good. And I know that the Queen had sent for him, and that he was worried about bad rumors being spread. And I know that the Queen's good to you, and I know that Lancelot is good to me, so I think they'd be great. I think it's fine.
And so they don't really establish the cause and effect or the explanation means this. It's more, hey, here's all the things. It's like somebody stuttering and struggling to make an argument.
And it sounds like that. It sounds like it's unsophistication. But when you get into it, you realize that it's very consistent and it's very intentional. And there are a lot of subtleties to it. So like, for instance, instead of making it clearer, the reasons, the link between the reasons, the author will draw more attention to the reasons themselves. So then the audience gets to listen to the story and debate amongst themselves. And that is why a lot of these stories, to finally answer to make the point I was trying to make, don't really have any continuity between them, because the way language was structured for English mythology in the medieval and early Middle Ages was built in a way that didn't explain the myths intentionally. Mm. So you would have, like, say, a story of an ogre that says, and the ogre was fearsome and he lived in the woods. And the woods were a terrifying place for the people of the town. And people in the town went missing all of the time. And sometimes the ogre came into town and terrorized everyone. And you don't actually have to be told the ogre's eating people in the woods.
You infer that yourself.
Yeah, and so then everyone gets to talk about it and tell these stories and be like, well, I know someone that went missing in the woods. It could have been this person. And I heard this story about this monster that was found in the woods. Maybe they're the same thing. And then so all these myths, like, naturally interlink. You've got to remember that this is not when the canon is being discussed. No. This is when the canon's being written.
Yeah.
And they're still in the middle of writing it. It was a collaborative process. And I think that's really the key thing. Because you can see influences from all sorts of other myths throughout ogres. There are clear influences from the Japanese Oni, mm-hmm. which are, like, multicolored tusked demons, usually that wear clothes and hold weapons and, like, have that, like, same sort of infernal, malevolent intelligence to them.
And who are actually listed under the ogre subcategory in the Monster Manual in D&D 5e.
True. You can look at... some people say that Beowulf was a big influence, which I don't think is actually true, because the reason that people say that Beowulf's orcs were a big influence on ogre myths is because of the similarity, because people think the similarity means that that's where Tolkien got his ideas from.
Yeah, that seems to be one of the biggest arguments for Beowulf's influence is the influence then on Tolkien, or the language links between orc, from the word orc, coming from orcus, and the word ogre.
Mm. So it is true that Tolkien did pretty much invent the modern ogre. And it is true that it does have links to orcus.
Mm.
But it is entirely just because, and I know this for a fact because I was reading letters that Tolkien wrote, it is entirely just because he appreciated the convenience of having a word that's so easily had a link to demons. Wow. That's the whole reason that orcs are called that, is because he liked how fitting the etymology would have been.
Wow. So it's really not much of a surprise, all the issues that have come out of orcs.
Yeah, so essentially, the reason that ogres and orcs are confusing is because we think that Tolkien had done some research, and he had... He just also intentionally disregarded most of his research and instead went with just kind of the general idea that had existed in every culture forever.
Wild.
And Tolkien himself talked in some letters. It's not clear in the stories themselves, but Tolkien, when asked about it, made it clear that he didn't think it was fair to say that even his orcs were, like, irredeemable evil monsters. And instead, they were just, like... I think his explanation was that they were goblins that had been corrupted by a god that was, like, forbidden from creating new intelligent, like, core races. Huh. Like, they'd made mankind and the elves and stuff, and they weren't supposed to make any more. And this guy had, like, so greatly altered goblins to be, like, the image that he wanted, that they weren't irredeemably evil. They were just a product of, like they were intentionally made into evil. But then could have been redeemed.
So they were just corrupted by an evil god is essentially what...
Yeah, yeah. Same idea as, like, and very obviously the same idea, actually, as goblins in D&D, yeah, which were just originally random people that were corrupted by an incredibly evil god. And that's where their association comes from. So I think that while I would probably avoid using some of that stuff very heavily in a game, because I would worry that it would, you'd get too much into the, like, these are evil by default things.
Mm.
There is some interesting nuance in even the, like, modern takes on that seem to be going that way, where it's just, like, even, like, Tolkien's orcs are the product of circumstance.
Yeah.
And yeah, so that's kind of where the ideas all come from. Yeah, it seems to mostly be ogres and orcus kind of being combined into one thing. It's cyclopses, wow, and and AUKUS being combined into one idea.
Yeah.
And that's where ogres come from.
That tracks pretty nicely. I think, Grace, if you want to pick up from here.
Oh, I mean, if I have to. No, it's good. Okay, so basically my bit is how in the past, as Lachlan said, the ogres were portrayed not just as like heavy-hitting dudes. They had a bit more nuance to them. They had like lives and careers and all that sort of shit. So basically we all agree, everyone agreed, the ogres, they eat people. They eat people.
They eat people.
They do love to eat folks.
Specifically eat babies.
Well, it's, you know, a little bite-sized snack. It's like popcorn chicken.
Yeah, it's just, you got to keep going.
Yeah, it's like a muesli bar. Babies just like muesli bars.
Yeah, it seems like that might be less about a specific preference for babies. Because I've never seen, I haven't been able to come across any attestations that they specifically prefer eating babies. I think they just all love eating people and babies are the easiest people to eat.
Yeah, plus, I mean, almost all of the ye olde myths about everything eating kids is they were just like, man, these kids just keep dying.
Kids did just be dying.
We've got to explain this. What if my kids went out into the forest one day to play and they didn't come back? Ogres.
Yep. Ooh. They got it.
Oh, man, the ogres really suck. Okay, so basically, in the original Puss in Boots, the like main villain is an ogre who lives in a castle. He's a rich boy. Mm. This man has a castle. So basically,
also just the whole myth, terrible to this ogre.
This dude was just hanging out in his house. He was hanging out in his house and two snacks walked in and he was like, I don't know how I feel about this one.
A cat just deliberately tries to kill him and steal his castle. That's just it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I've been around cats. I know what they're like. I will also note giants are from like the same thing as well.
Yeah.
Especially considering the like biblical origins. Oh, I didn't mention the biblical origins. The biblical connection is literally just there was a guy called King Og and he was probably an ogre and he was a big evil king and Moses killed him.
Huh.
He's mentioned for like 4 seconds in like the Book of Numbers and like once in another book.
That sounds like the Bible.
And then there's like a bunch of like not technically canon like Hebrew writings. There's like the book of like King Og's adventures and it's canon in like one sect of Judeo-Christian sect and it's literally just stories of King Og and some giants like killing dragons and shit.
It's
and
the that's kid's just picture like, book spin-off.
Yeah, exactly. It's just like a book about ogres fighting ogres and giants fighting dragons. It's super cool and some people believe that it is religious truth. And I think that is incredible. Probably true.
I think they're right. I really appreciate the way people approach biblical texts in the same way that I like to approach Marvel movies, which is if I don't like it, it didn't happen and it's not canon, I just won't interact with it anymore. Mm. And I like the idea of reading the Bible and being like, no, I don't agree with this chapter. I think this is out of character and Jesus wouldn't have done that.
Fucking King Og was too OOC in this book, so I actually don't think that we should. I don't think we should keep this one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, if you look at who the writers are, you totally understand that they were influencing the work, and they're not sticking to the canon. So.
Ugh. Honestly.
Okay. So basically, the idea of these ogres living in castles. I mean, we've done castles. That takes a lot of manpower to build. These ogres with castles and homes and shit. They were powerful people, fully capable of interacting with humans and the environment around them and held positions of, like, power and importance. Because you're not going to bother building a castle for someone who's just, like, a bit scary.
Hell, they're probably lords.
Honestly, based on the old mythology, it would likely go unexplained in the actual stories about ogres because it would have just been seen as one of those like, well, obviously things because of the cultural history. He almost definitely built that castle himself because I mean there were literally. There's a type of architecture called cyclopean walls because there were some cities in ancient Greece with a very specific type of stone wall that the story behind them was cyclopses or ogres or giants or whatever they thought of them as, had built them in ancient times. Mm. So, like, almost definitely people would have talked about the king in Puss in Boots, the ogre king in Puss in Boots, as having built his own castle.
Mm. Fun fact about this ogre in this castle, he's a shapeshifter. This bad boy?
Fuck yes.
He's like, I could be something else, but I choose to be an ogre, and honestly, the body positivity, delicious. Yeah, this guy shapeshifts into all sorts of animals, which, I mean, probably links back to Lachlan's idea of them as being seen as, like, other than human, closer to the mystery of a wild animal than necessarily a monster.
Oh, yeah, from that, like, Greek pagan kind of golden age idea.
Because in the story, he changes into a bunch of different animals to show his power. He turns into, like, a lion and all sorts of other stuff. And, I mean, the story ends with him being turned into a mouse. Which, very powerful, very brave.
Mm.
Not a great idea, narratively speaking.
No.
So there's another...
And this was written in Italy in the 16th century. Yeah, absolutely. This is like, prime...
Mm.
Just as it's getting out of Old English, out of the, like, weirdness of the Old English, and they're finally getting into, like, the elaborate mythos.
I think this is one of the French ones, actually. This is Charles Perrault.
Yeah, no, I know. But I'm saying that, like, the reason that this story would keep a lot of the intricacies as opposed to the older ones, which would be up for more debate, would be because once you got it into English, it would be a more one-to-one translation from the French by this time.
Yeah.
Because we'd be looking at modern English.
Yeah. So I think Tully and I spoke about this one the last time we played D&D, actually. There's another story called Hop O' My Thumb, where basically the ogre's just like, he has a family home. He has a wife. He has seven daughters. He has a bunch of daughters.
They're just straight up folks.
They just do. They just live in a house. They're just people. They have a little house. I'm pretty sure they're living in, like, the forest with his wife and his children. Mm-hmm. These are just, like, hanging out. Yeah. These are completely normal ogres.
Yeah, which I think really draws attention to, like, the comparison to the Fae. This is just, like, another thing with just a society you can't understand.
Mm.
There's a great, from Hop on My Thumb, there's a great quote here. This follows, as this ogre's wife is offering Hop on My Thumb and his six brothers accommodation for the night. She's saying, "Oh, I'm going to hide you because my husband will kill you." But for although this ogre ate up little children, he was a good husband, and that's just the perfect, like, that. That is just abusive relationships 101. That's just how it comes across.
But I mean that would have made so much sense to the people who heard that at the time, because they would have just been like, well, yeah, of course the ogre does some things that seem really fucked up to us. They eat people.
Yeah, they eat people.
I'm sure a lot of their customs seem gnarly, and that would have just been, like, how you deal with it. I will note, Perrault, who, like, popularized this story, was the guy who invented the word ogre.
Sexy. Yes.
Yeah.
Good for him. Also,
he was the one that finally took all those things and made him ogre, specifically.
Just want to say, if I'm a 16th century woman living in the middle of the forest with my six daughters and my husband sometimes like to kill some kids, but otherwise is a great guy, I'd probably be like, all right.
If they're not your kids.
You're not eating my kids. We're just hanging out. You can have somebody else's. Mm. Who let their kids wander around the forest anyway? That's on you. But yeah, basically he has a wife, he has daughters, he lives in a house. As Tully said, they let these little boys stay in their house overnight. And, I mean, the daddy ogre does find them.
Mm-hmm.
The story that I have was talking about them not being invited in so much as lured in. And the idea was that this ogre wanted them inside the house because it's easier to grab a bunch of kids out of bed at night than it is to chase them around the woods all day.
Ah.
So the idea was, like, this ogre was more brains than brawn and was like, actually, this is going to be way easier. Yeah, come stay the night. We'll put you up in the room with our daughters. They'll keep an eye on you. I'll sneak in, scoop you all up, and it won't be a problem. And the only reason there was any, like, conflict in the story was the fact that these boys were like, my mum told me not to trust ogres, so I'm going to leave really early in the morning before you can come and get me.
Specifically, Hop of My Thumb, the six brothers, dumb as dog shit. But this one kid who was supposedly the little scrawny one, that's the moral of the story, because all these French tales had morals.
Yeah.
The moral of the story is Hop of My Thumb, the scrawny one, was the one that brought the family wealth.
Yeah, who listened to the stories and was like, we cannot trust ogres, we have to leave. And listening to the stories was what kept him alive and brought him immense wealth.
Mm.
So it was sort of like a, yeah, so you've been told ogres will hit you. What happens when they're smart? Still, do not trust these guys. Leave.
Yeah, and I think that tracks with some of the... I was reading what the Encyclopedia Britannica had on ogres, and they were talking about how it's also been commonly used as a literary allegory for tyrants and despots and dictators and stuff. The sort of person who, for their own aims, will swallow up human life. Well, essentially just treating their subjects as disposable. And just consuming their life force and their labor for their own personal aims. So I think that it seems that association was actually built between cannibalism and the wastefulness of tyrants with human life seems to have actually been drawn pretty early, because it seems like a lot of these are the head of a household or the head of a castle or something, who is just throwing away human lives for nothing just because it's makes their life a little bit more convenient.
Mm.
Yeah.
So I just think it's interesting that seems to be such a recurring theme, because it's so different from how we see ogres as this monster in the swamps or in the caves or whatever.
It changes it from a monster to a brutish authority.
Yeah, it's supposed to be it was so often an allegory for authority.
Yeah. Mm.
Which I think is just an interesting element to kind of bring back into.
Yeah, to bring back into
our
portrayals.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, Tully, did you want to talk about how you were going to loop yours into... Because we have we had a lot of overlap, so we could sort of...
We can sort of vibe on
we
that.
We can Venn diagram our two pieces together and meet in the middle.
Yeah, sort of we'll dovetail it together.
Is that what you got then?
Yeah, that's really the stuff that I had that I thought was interesting and useful.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool.
So I am basically looking at ogres post the invention of the word, and that sort of early mythos where ogres became a... Not a defined myth, but they became a myth as distinct from giants or cyclops.
So when ogres themselves...
Basically,
when ogres became ogres. Ogres,
yeah. So when they distinctly became ogres.
Because it is interesting that we never really dropped a lot of those older ideas and the older names for what was ostensibly the exact same creature across different cultures.
Yeah.
We just took all of them and we've made them all different now.
Yeah, and it is worth mentioning here that I am deliberately excluding the myth of the Oni, because it is actually its own distinct mythos, and I think it probably deserves its own...
Oh, absolutely.
Its own spotlight there.
There's a reason that I only mentioned Oni in the sense of, some of the physical characteristics probably derived from stories of the Oni, because the Oni is just, its whole own thing.
Yeah, and it's...
Yokai in general is just, a whole complicated...
We should
do
Yokai.
I love Yokai. Have you guys seen the TV show Yokai Watch? It's great. It's it's literally kind of half Ben 10, half Pokemon, but with little Japanese spirits.
I played the demo for the 3DS game.
Was it good?
It was fine.
It was fun.
It was just like Pokemon, but easier.
Nice.
I think it's for a younger audience.
Yeah, I think so.
But yeah, so basically the first distinct reference of ogres, not with the word ogre, which was later used by... Right. Oh, no, actually, sorry. This does appear to be the earliest. This is in Percival's Story of the Grail, which is, again, a French story.
Mm-hmm.
And it talks about the colonization of Albion, which is what we know as England. And it talks about... basically, the idea is there's a rhyme that includes the land of Loga... and it's full of ogres.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I've seen this. No, you're right. It was Perrault that did the thing with it that turned ogres into, that like combined those two things. But you're right, it was totally that.
It was a convenient rhyme.
That verse is absolutely where it came from.
And these giants, that these ogres that were supposed to have roamed the land, were actually also referred to as giants very frequently. These giants were begat from, there's Albina, who was one of the women that colonized Albion. Mating, they didn't have any men with them, so they mated with incubi, creating a race of giants, who, from there on, they were reported as being 20 cubits tall, which is at least 30 feet by the smallest measurement of what a cubit is.
Mm-hmm. That is based off of, I assume, the Bible? That's King Og. That's King Og's, the size of King Og's bed.
Yes, Gog Magog is the most famous of them. So Gog Magog is the later myth that I'm assuming comes from King Og.
Well, King Og is only significant in that he was the only survivor of when all the giants were killed. So,
and is the last...
There were other, like, more important giants before him. He was just, like, the only one that Moses was still... Was around when Moses could kill him.
Well, in the French myth...
Late 12th century, Percival.
Oh, Percival, okay. So part of what I'm going to talk about here is I'm going to take these myths and figure out how to make them more interesting. So it's not just, hey, it's a big thing that hits you.
Mm.
Because ogres, specifically the D&D 5e stat block, it's fucking boring.
Yeah, they're just big zombies, really.
Pretty much.
They're just big zombies.
They're big, dumb, slow, and hit hard.
Like, straight down to the, they just kind of hit you, and if you don't do damage in the right way, then they just refuse to die.
Oh, no, that's kind of their thing. That's not even a thing. I got confused. That's trolls.
Is that trolls? Is that not even ogres?
That's not even ogres.
God, ogres are so lame in D&D.
They are. Basically, he's reported of being at least 20 cubits tall, but after he broke Corineus's ribs, so Gog Magog broke 3 of Corineus's ribs.
As you do.
Corineus then picked up Gog Magog and threw him off a cliff.
Good.
Which is not something that a normal man can do to a 30-foot creature. So
his bones are hollow, like a bird.
Like a bird. From this, I'm taking that Gog Magog was able to be as tall as he was, or may have just been big. But was also light enough to have been thrown off a cliff by a man with 3 broken ribs. And I'll kind of refer back to this because the next stuff I'm going to talk about is the stories of Charles Perrault, who wrote a book with, I think, 6 different stories that included ogres out of the whole collection of stories.
He loved ogres.
So we've got Hop on My Thumb. Now, this is more about the personalities of them, which is that they are cunning. They like to trick people. But they're also very easily fooled. Now, the example here is that basically he was convinced to, or convinced them, the children to, whichever way you want to see it, to stay in his house overnight and eat them in the morning. That was sort of the idea. In the one that I read, his wife, the ogre's wife, convinces him to eat them in the morning.
Which is, not to keep harping on it, but you can see some clear influence of the Odyssey in there.
Yeah, absolutely. And so what happens is this giant has 7 daughters. Each of them wear a golden crown. Now, this golden crown pops up very regularly. So this is something you notice when I used the ogre in our game, he was wearing a golden circlet.
Mm-hmm.
That was just, I don't know what that does yet. That's a clear influence from...
That's just fun.
Yeah.
It's just flavor text.
Flavor text.
They're the Rephaim in Hebrew, the giants. I will note, it seems like there is some contention biblically as to whether or not the giants were that tall, because originally King Og specifically was considered to be 13 feet tall. Huh. Between 9 and 13 feet. But later on, rabbis stopped talking about the cubits of his bed as being the, like, because the cubit was, the length of a forearm, roughly. Rabbis later started saying that Og's cubits were measured to his forearm, not to a human's forearm. So that's why you'll see in, like, the early biblical accounts, he seems to be much shorter than the 30 feet that he and his kind become later on.
Yeah.
Because later on, they're using their own arms to measure their height.
Oh,
but the actual values, the units don't change.
There you go.
So the qubit becomes twice as long.
Wild.
So is that?
Yeah. So basically what happens is, in the story, spoiler warning for Hop on My Thumb, in case you're intending to read it.
I mean, look, it's going to be... I'll cover my ears.
I'll take my headphones off.
So basically what happens is, overnight, Hop on My Thumb wakes up super early, and knowing that the giant is going to recognize his daughters by their golden crowns, swaps the golden crowns that they are wearing while they're sleeping with the bonnets that he and his brothers were wearing. And so the ogre, when he wakes up earlier than Hop on My Thumb to kill them in the middle of the night, slits the throats of his seven daughters and goes back to bed. Thinking that they were the brothers.
Interesting.
Because they were wearing the bonnets. So they are very easily fooled. And this actually frequently happens. All of these myths have these ogres that are cunning. They are tricksy. They will try and deceive you. But they are also very easily fooled.
And again, it really speaks to that fae connection. That like very like, into like the pagan origins of the myth. In the sense that your biggest threat when you encounter an ogre is always going to be that you don't know how the ogre functions. You don't know going into an ogre's house that just being here means you're going to be eaten in the morning, and now because of some weird custom, you're stuck here and you can't leave.
Yep.
And you're just going to die. But you also can hope that because of the specificity of their rules, that you can use them against them by being like, well, if your rules say that you're going to eat anyone that has this bonnet, that has this circlet on,
yeah,
then I'm just going to put the circlet on someone else.
Yeah, and so I'm not sure if it's by the rules or by the, like, just they are gullible.
Oh, yeah, but
both are doable.
And that's what I'm saying. Like, it seems like the ogres have a very similar concept to the fae, wherein they have, like, very specific customs and rules that they are, that both put you in danger but can also, like, backfire on them if you work out the rules. But rather than the fae, who, like, have a book of rules, it seems like the ogre is just kind of, like, more intuition-based, which is interesting. Rather than having, like you, it doesn't seem like you could ask another ogre what the rules of one ogre is.
Yeah. There's actually, further on in the story, once Hop on My Thumb disappears, basically Hop on My Thumb wakes up his six brothers after the others have been killed and says, "We got to get out of here, let's go." So they book it. The wife wakes up to go wake up her daughters, sees them all drenched in blood, and faints. And there's a little dry comment from Perro there, like something like, as a mother is wont to do in a situation like this, basically saying, you would too, wouldn't you? So
that is a very, like, fucking the late 17th century French comment to add to a thing.
As a woman would do.
After all the time I spent looking at the differences between like Middle English and French at the time, like, that's such a French thing to say.
Absolutely it is.
Because old English authors had, in the words of one scholar, the tact to remain in the background. The French, not so much. They wanted you to know what they thought.
Yeah, exactly.
This was about them, not the story.
So what happened is the wife faints, and the ogre, who desperately wants to make to avenge his daughter's deaths so that his wife isn't upset with him, which is, again, a very French sentiment, I think.
Oh, yeah.
Very 17th
Fuck
century
my
French.
Kids. I love my wife.
Yeah. So
well, kids died all the time. Wives hopefully didn't. Mm.
So he puts on his 7-league boots, which are a magic item that I will be talking about later, which allow him to travel fast distances, and he goes racing after them. Now, Hop on My Thumb sees this over the distance and gets all his brothers to hide, and eventually the ogre gets to where they are and is so exhausted from wearing these 7-league boots that he sits down and takes a nap. At which point, Hop on My Thumb steals his magic boots, runs back to the ogre's house to tell the ogre's wife, Your husband's been captured, and they're demanding that he give over all of his riches. He gave me these boots to give you this message. You'll need to give me all of your riches to save his life.
And then he just takes it and leaves?
And he just takes it, fucks off, and goes back home.
Because the ogre's out in the woods. He's not going to get back.
Without his 7-league boots.
Oh, he'll never get back in time.
And
his
so
poor wife.
That's the story. Yeah, his poor wife. So that's Hop on My Thumb. And the whole thing that I get from that is they are very willing to trick you, but very gullible themselves. And it sort of it strikes me as a high charisma, low wisdom kind of character. If we're going to use the 5e terms,
yeah.
So they're actually, I would say they are remarkably charismatic. They're in positions of power.
I would argue, probably high wisdom, just low intelligence. It seems like because there is like an innate understanding to them, and because that innate understanding doesn't extend to the complexities of like human socialization, they're not on the lookout for deceit. They're on the lookout for like manipulation and trickery.
Yeah.
And if you clearly actually did show up with my husband's boots, then like, well, like if you show up saying you're in my husband's boots, I think an ogre is looking for a sign. These are the wrong boots, or a sign that like,
yeah,
he's looking for a trick, not for just outright deceit. It seems like they're not capable in the myths of seeing that this adds up because you planned it well.
Yeah.
They're like, this adds up because it must be true.
Yeah. So that's sort of the personality traits, and I would like to bring a little bit more of that.
It's purely deductive reasoning. I think that's what it is. It's purely deductive reasoning.
So
based on rules that we don't know.
And the next story kind of follows this up. Again, as Grace mentioned, this is the Master Cat, or Puss in Boots. And putting aside the details of the story itself, because the ogre is actually less of a villain and more like a side character. But essentially what happens with this ogre is Puss in Boots appears and says, "Oh, Master Ogre, there are tales of you being fearsome, and I heard that you can transform into all manner of things, but I don't really believe it. And surely you can't be something as fearsome as a lion." And so he transforms into a lion to prove that he's this great, powerful shapeshifter. And Puss in Boots goes, "Oh no, you're terrifying. But surely someone as large and majestic as you couldn't be something as tame and meek as a mouse." And so just to prove a point, he turns into a mouse and Puss in Boots eats him.
Yeah. I think it's interesting because it really does seem like, because these creatures are supposed to be like timeless and powerful and like eat people for fun or for food or whatever, depending on what story you're looking at, they really do just regard themselves as like inherently superior. And so like maybe hubris is possibly their biggest downfall most of the time.
Speaking of, if you look at the traditional Sleeping Beauty, what has become the wicked stepmother was actually an ogre queen.
Oh,
she was an ogre pretending to be the queen. So basically, what happens is she, as the queen,
in Sleeping Beauty,
yeah,
in the Disney film.
I didn't realize the mum in Sleeping Beauty was bad. I thought it was the witch.
So
she has a bad mum too.
Yeah.
Jesus, this poor girl. I'm glad she only lived in the forest however long.
I think it's kind of split off. I didn't look too much into how it became what it did, but I think the witch actually is sort of a split off from what was the stepmother.
Well, because, and I mean, it's a lot clearer, I think, I think the Maleficent, the movie, did a better job of giving like the vibe of these old stories and stuff, but you can kind of see it throughout the old Disney ones as well. They didn't really see the fairies and the like magic things in the way that they weren't like witches and wizards in the way that I feel like we tend to think of them now.
They're people with magic.
Yeah, even back then it was like either someone with like weird power or some creature that looked like a person. And like, because even like the fairy godmother obeys, like in Cinderella for instance, obeys like weirdly a fae-esque rules. Maleficent curses Aurora because of the, and it's like a lesson about like, well, you thought she was dangerous, so you shouldn't have invited her, but being mean to her was really the only reason she'd be dangerous. It's like a very, like, all of these things are embodiments of, more so of magic and chaos and an obstacle that the protagonist has to overcome, and less creatures in their own right. They're more responses from the world to your behavior than anything else.
Well, so this story, essentially, this ogress queen, who is a hidden ogress, she's disguised as the king's wife. Whether or not this is as, you know, the original wife or a second wife or whatever. It's sort of the stepmother is what came from it, the wicked stepmother. But she demands to eat Sleeping Beauty's children and then her. Now, the what Sleeping Beauty does instead, well, so what the chefs do instead is, instead of the first child, they substitute it with a lamb. In the second meal, they substitute the second child with a goat. And then instead of Beauty herself, they use a red deer, which are these very large deer. And the Ogress Queen does not tell the difference, does not know what the difference is, and happily eats those up as if they were the children and Beauty herself. Then this Ogress Queen at this point in the story has prepared a pit of vipers and other noxious creatures.
Of course.
For the king is going to topple him and become the queen. But Sleeping Beauty comes out and exposes her for what she is. And once discovered, she throws herself into her pre-prepared pit of vipers and other noxious creatures to be eaten alive.
Interesting.
So just having been discovered, she was like, nope, that's it. I'm throwing myself into a pit of death.
And see, that's what I'm saying when I say that I think that they follow rules. That just the people who were writing the stories at the time thought was so either self-evident or otherwise so alien as to just be unexplainable anyway, and that was kind of the point, that they didn't write them down. Because it seems like a lot of these creatures are just kind of being like, well, you bested me, I know when I've been beat.
And
even though they could then later defend themselves, like I'm sure that as soon as Puss in Boots put that ogre mouse in his mouth, the ogre could have then turned back into a lion and exploded Puss in Boots' head.
Mm.
But he was like, well, you got me. You fucking got me, dude.
And basically, yeah, a lot of this myth is very specific. I'm going to do a bit of a speed run at this point because I know I've been rambling on about a lot of different stories. I've got here the bee in the orange tree. There's an ogre couple finds an orphan and decides an orphan girl as a baby and decides to raise her rather than eat her in order to marry her to their son. So it shows that they actually they have families, they build relationships with people. They are cannibalistic, but they're not animals. They don't just kind of eat you because they do.
Well, they're also not. I think it's important to
they're not cannibalistic.
There is a lot of association in mythology between them and cannibals, but they are distinctly not human.
They don't eat ogres.
They are these immortal creatures that would see humans in a very similar way to humans at the time seeing like livestock and stuff and like game animals, things that just kind of like existed and were around and you outlived them. So you would see like 15 generations of them in your lifetime.
And they have a stunning link to nature. In this story, they actually call upon a red deer to nurse the child.
Interesting.
And they speak their own language. They speak giant, as shown in here. Or I'm assuming they speak giant. They speak a language of their own because as they raise this human child, she's not capable of speaking to people from the land that she comes from.
She can only speak to other
ogres.
Like giants and ogres and shit.
Yeah. So there's also a link that they raised more animals. They actually had a camel that they used as a pack animal that this child steals. They also had a lot of magic artifacts. Now, magic artifacts are really common in ogre myths. There's the seven-league boots that we had before. In this particular story, they had a wand that could transform the princess into a boat woman, the prince into a boat, the camel into a lake. She turns a camel into a lake.
I think we need more of that. I think that's the reason why we've had so many droughts recently is because we don't have enough ogres turning camels
into lakes.
We have a lot of camels in Australia. Could you imagine if we just like laked some of them?
And they also they wore gold crowns and the crowns were an identifying feature of things that they didn't eat.
It is remarkable that you said that because I was just thinking, like we joke as a society, but the fact that homeopathy came to exist in a world where, like, fucking half the myths were like, well, I don't know, camels don't need water for a long time, so they probably have lots of water in them. So I guess if you were to turn a camel into anything, it'd probably be a lake, because camels don't drink water. And, like, that's your thought process? Like, of course we thought that fucking a walnut looks like your brain, so it cures your brain tumor. We were on some fucking wacky shit.
Yep.
Turn a camel into a lake just because camels don't fucking drink much. That's the opposite of how that works. I guess they have more water in them. But it's like, shut up.
Weirdly enough, if you squeeze a camel like a wet rag, a lake full of water will come out.
That yep. does make sense. I just think that's remarkable.
So I've got another three myths before I go into actually like building something a little bit, or just throwing it to the floor.
Okay, sorry. I'll let you get through it.
Yeah. Then. So there's one of bearskin. So there's a princess is trusted to the ogre rhinoceros. Yes, the ogre is named rhinoceros.
Is that where the word came from?
No. This is after the animal came around.
What?
Because his favorite form was a rhinoceros. He could transform into a rhinoceros.
Oh,
and so
fuck,
this is
that's
what
funny.
He became. When he went hunting, he was a rhinoceros. So the princess is able... The princess, who has a, you know, a fairy godmother of sorts, the fairy godmother sews her into a bear skin, but... Because of that, she magically turns into a bear.
Of course.
This isn't the fairy godmother's doing. This is just magic that happens.
Yeah, this is just how it works. Of course.
So I think bears ogres like having that. Magical lairs is also very good, like latent magic that sits around. And the prince, so the princess turns into a bear, then believes the ogre then comes back, rhinoceros comes back, and the fairy godmother tells him that he ate the princess in his barbarous rage. And rhinoceros believes her.
Cool.
They are rather gullible again.
I mean, to be fair,
and then he
if I got upset and Lachlan and I went looking for something and I was like, oh my God, where are the 2-minute noodles? Where is the bag of chips? And Lachlan was like, you got upset them. Last night and you ate them. I'd be like, oh, yeah, that's, yeah.
That sounds
you know
like
what?
Me.
Classic.
He then bribes his way into the nursery of the castle, in order to eat the children overnight, disguises himself as an astrologer to convince the king that his wife did it. He also is noted as having 7-league boots. That's just more a side note than anything else. Pero just really loved these 7-league boots. This is the Italian's tales. This is from Pentameron.
A lot of those tales were what Perrault was drawing from when he... Because, weirdly enough... There was a weird trend around this time to essentially just rewrite other people's stories in your language with your style, and that was kind of it, because it would just be like, oh, well, this story was cool in French. I'll write it.
Yeah.
I'll write it now. It's
and
mine.
Again, there's this, oh no, I've been defeated, I must leave kind of thing, where he gets exposed by the princess who he had captured, who turned into a bear, who then turned not into a bear, to expose him for trying to trick the king into killing his wife. Really, there doesn't seem to be any, apart from amassing power and eating people, there doesn't seem to be much of a motive to anything else that they do.
Yeah, they're very...
They've got simple goals.
They're very mundane in that sense, yeah. which I think speaks to them being used more as an allegory for things that people actually did, because it would be like, yeah, no, they really do just want kind of wealth and power.
Yeah.
That's it.
So then there's, again from Pentameron, there's the Tale of the Ogre, in which there are a lot of magic items. Now, this is actually a really funny one because the ogre takes on essentially an apprentice, basically free labor in exchange for food and board, and gives this, and it's about a gullible kid. That's literally what this one's about. And he basically takes this kid in and says, okay, I've got a task for you. I've got this donkey here that pisses gold. It literally, well, it doesn't show whether it pisses gold or it shits gold, but it excretes gold in some way. Incredible riches. When you say a certain key word. And so he says to the boy, okay, take this to a certain place. I need it to go look after this while I'm away. Go to the nearest inn. Keep it safe. And then the child, wanting to sell it for his own gain, runs away. He takes it to the inn, And he says to the innkeeper, don't say the magic words. And so the innkeeper says the magic words, realizes it's a magic donkey, and then swaps it out for a mundane donkey, and he loses the donkey. So he comes back tail between his legs to the ogre, and the ogre goes, I can't believe you've done this, you stupid child. Well, take this magic item, look after it. It's curtains. If you say open, they open. If you say close, they close. Don't say those words around them. And so the child again tries to run away with this item, says open. There's riches behind it. It's a portal to a magic vault. So he goes, runs away, you know, stays in the inn overnight and says, keep this away from anyone who would say open or close. And the shopkeeper does exactly the same thing, steals him away. The last bit is, obviously, everyone gets their comeuppance. The ogre says, Guru, you stupid child, you lost another thing. Here, take this magic club. If you say up, don't say up or down. So he says up, and it starts beating him on the head. Says down, and it stops. So he takes it to the innkeeper and says, don't say up. And it starts beating up the innkeeper forever. And he steals the magic items back and makes his riches.
Okay, so it's a lesson about, like, that one really is directly a lesson about, like, don't fuck around with the rules of something that you don't really understand.
Yes.
It's like sometimes things have an inherent power to them that you don't know how to deal with.
And also, don't trust innkeepers.
Yes.
And don't trust innkeepers.
I took four lessons from this. They have lots of magic items.
Yes.
Tons of magic items. They love free labor.
Yes.
Like so much so that even if the kid has lost two of his magic items, he's willing to give more of them.
Yeah.
They're bound to oaths. He didn't eat him because the kid was in his service. Mm. And he was forgiving. He was willing to believe him a second time and a third time.
It's very clear that that story is just talking about, like, royalty. Like, that's not even so much an allegory as just straight up, like, this is just a ruler. We're just going to make him an ogre.
Yeah. That's what I took from that era of mythology as ogres were being defined. So, in the last sort of little bit, I know I've harped on for far too long, but essentially, when you're thinking about including ogres in your game, rather than just a big thing that hits stuff, have a think about these sorts of things. There's obviously they are shapeshifters. That has been very consistent throughout almost every myth of ogres.
Yeah, you should definitely be giving your ogres access to some wild shapes or some transmutation spells or something like that.
So in our last game, I experimented with an ogre that had wild shapes just like a druid would, with a favored form of a lion. Now, it does seem like they have their favorite forms, but also they are able to transform into different stuff. Also, other humanoid forms.
Yeah.
And I, again, played with this a little bit in our game by allowing this ogre to change size. So his true size was enormous, but to get around normally, he would just walk around as kind of like a tall dude. In fact, no, he walked around almost dwarven stature.
You described him originally as like a weird-looking halfling.
Yeah, he was about 4 or 5 feet tall, wearing a bearskin that was way too big for him.
Yeah, it seemed like, because my character's a goblin, it seemed like he was just like another kind of goblinkin.
Yeah, and then he started growing until his head touched the ceiling.
Yeah.
This was in an arena battle.
Yeah, I decided to get into like an illegal cage fight. And then Tully was like, cool, well, the enemy's an ogre. And I was like, oh, fuck. And then Tully was like, the ogre can shapeshift. And I was like, oh, just shit.
It was a close fight.
It was.
It got down literally to 1 HP.
I had 1 HP by the end.
You were knocked unconscious.
He did. The only reason I was knocked unconscious was because I knocked him unconscious while he was grappling me and he dropped me.
Yeah.
Was the reason I still technically won the fight.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And my character sat outside of the cage fight and had popcorn because I said, you know what? I got like 7 HP left. I'm going to sit this one out, guys. You go ahead and have fun.
Yep. So that goes into changing size as well. Rather than just like illusion, I think it makes sense for ogres based on the various descriptions of sizes and being able to have to run homes and talk to people, but also be enormous creatures, that they can truly reduce their size and that their standard size is just big.
Yeah.
It's just very big.
Yeah. And I think the thing that I took, especially from the stories that you guys brought, is ogres really seem to be, to my mind, one of the better opportunities to introduce this idea of, like, a pagan magic to your world.
Yeah.
This idea of, like, an inherent and powerful magic. Because in D&D, we treat magic, I feel, very often, and for good reason, I think, because it makes it more manageable, it makes it easier to understand, to the people that are playing, but we treat it too much like a science, I think.
Yeah.
And you've got to remember that, and I talked about this a bit during our plagues episode as well, like, this was a time where doctors were writing cures down in their medical notes that were literally just strap a snake to you for this condition, because anecdotally, I've seen people who have done that get better.
Yeah.
And the explanation for that was, oh, well, it's just magic. It's an inherent magical property of this item, and the way it interacts with this condition, and it's completely not understandable. There's no reason to try and understand it, and the only way that you could understand a lot of this magic was literally just through experience.
Yeah.
You just happened to have to find out that this snake amulet worked, and then the snake amulet just worked, and that was it. You couldn't explain it from there. It was just how it worked, and I think that this is a really good way to bring that stuff in by having these, like, weird rules that ogres have to follow and all their magic items and stuff, and having them, like, be weirdly following a bunch of social conventions but disregarding, like, prohibitions on murder.
Yeah.
I think is just a really good way to bring in this idea of, like, sometimes things just have inherent rules and inherent qualities to them that we don't understand, which was such a big part of medieval life. I mean, the reason that these stories picked up is because that was how people looked at the world.
Yeah.
If you thought you could understand the world, then you wouldn't care about these stories, because it would seem the same as it seems to us, like fiction. But to them, it's like, fucking anything can happen.
Yeah. So try and make your ogres a little bit inscrutable, not because you're pulling shit out of your ass, but because they are, I guess, greater beings that do have some form of rules that you don't quite understand.
Yeah, you should have rules to these things. You don't have to have a reason for those rules.
Yeah.
Because you weren't supposed to. They were just how things worked. The same as we happen to live on a planet with air.
Yeah.
It's just how things are.
And so my ogre in our town is the apothecary, and I'm looking forward to a little more interaction with
that actually is a really good way to do that, to just put him straight into, like, fucking some pagan bullshit.
Yeah, pretty much. He's the pagan bullshit guy in the town.
Yeah.
So yeah, anything else you wanted to add, Grace?
Not really. No.
Yeah.
No, I think it's covered. We got pagan bullshit, we've got big boots, we've got cats. Hell yeah.
I think that's going to be the soundbite I use to advertise this episode.
Fuck yeah.
Yep. Anyway, thank you very much for listening once again. It's been stunning being back in the studio with these wonderful people. I'm hoping that they enjoyed being here with me.
But I'm not going to, like,
not going to say it.
Tell Tully that.
Yeah, I'd never admit it to him.
Cool, we've got two intelligent people and a numbskull in a studio once more. Thank you so much for listening. If you want to get in contact, be sure to catch us on our socials at Dungeon Deep Dive.
Or shoot us an email at deepdivetnc@gmail.com, which I actually remembered for once. And I promise I'll check it. I say that every time and I don't, but this time I mean it.
Tweet at us, because everyone keeps ignoring the fact that I keep sending memes to Dungeon Deep Dive Twitter account and nobody ever reposts them from the inbox. So make sure that the account gets used, that people pay attention to my cheese meme.
Well, look, that has been us for another fortnight. Thank you so much for sticking with us so far. Or if you're a new listener, thank you for joining. Until then, I don't have a sign off.
We love you.
Bye.
Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stevens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloane.